Esteemed Vice Rector, dear audience. Imagine working in a place where every day there's an opportunity to create and investigate something which no one in the history of the universe has ever seen before. Sorry. No, what's going on? What's it got? In the same place, young students, senior researchers, and even professors can often be found late at night working side by side to fight with a complex piece of equipment or a computer code in order to make these observations possible. Alongside the researchers, a dedicated team of technicians pays careful attention. The beam of particles is guided accurately to the target and the experimental apparatus. You can imagine how the researchers feel when what may be after several years of their hard work, the fruits of their labour start to be seen in the middle of the night. You may think that I'm describing a well-known hunt for the Higgs boson at CERN in Geneva, but I am in fact describing the day-to-day happenings in the accelerator laboratory just across the lake in the Department of Physics. I still remember well the day that my future PhD supervisor, Professor Peter Butler, met me in the University of Liverpool in autumn 1995. He asked that if, before I officially started my PhD in October, could I come to Finland for 2 weeks in an experiment to be carried out in a place called Jyväskylä. Now, this was a very interesting time to make a first visit to the accelerator laboratory. The new K130 cyclotron had just been commissioned. The UK community was starting to recover from the shock of the closure of the Daresbury laboratory in 1992. And indeed, the sad fate of the UK facility was to play an important and significant role in the development of the vascular accelerator laboratory. The UK physics community was left without a permanent home and chose to relocate a significant amount of its equipment from Daresbury to Jyväskylä. And clearly these developments were beneficial for both parties. The UK community could continue with their experimental programs, and the newly founded accelerator laboratory benefited from an influx of equipment and expertise. And the main programs of gamma ray, electron and laser spectroscopy are still very visible in the accelerator laboratory today, even 20 years later. Since those early days, the accelerator laboratory has grown, both in physical size and in stature within the worldwide physics, nuclear physics community. The laboratory now hosts 4 accelerators and has been recognised as a large-scale facility of the European Union since 1996. And it's recently commenced its 3rd consecutive term as a centre of excellence of the Academy of Finland. Particularly in my own field, nuclear spectroscopy, the continued support and investment in equipment from the UK community has been essential in our success with the UFL Accelerator Laboratory. In the last decade or so, UK investments have gone well over €10 million, and such investments would be impossible, pretty much impossible, through the normal channels available to Finnish researchers. And most recently, the Accelerator Laboratory has been selected for addition to the so-called FIRI roadmap of research infrastructures in an evaluation carried out by the Academy of Finland. And as I said, until recently it was almost impossible to scale to secure funds for such large-scale infrastructure projects, and we sincerely hope that this recognition of the facility at the national level will lead to increased and regular funding for such infrastructure at the lab. Today, the research in the accelerator laboratory is carried out on many fronts, including studies of materials and surfaces at the Pellitron laboratory, and various space science and industrial applications at the RADEF facility. And indeed, the RADEF activities are a very important source of income for the laboratory. The main purpose of the laboratory and the main reason for its reputation worldwide is for basic research which is carried out into the structure of the nucleus. The ultimate goal of this research is to obtain a better understanding of the fundamental forces at work in the nucleus binding the protons and neutrons together. And despite over 100 years of research since Rutherford discovered the nucleus in 1911, we still do not have a perfect understanding of the nuclear force, nor do we have a single theory which can predict us the property of nuclei throughout the charge of the nucleus, which is shown here on this slide. So there are 288 stable nucleides, which are marked in black. And in the laboratory experiments, we've managed to produce around 3,000 radioactive isotopes. And according to current theoretical studies, there should be around 7,000 nuclei which we can produce. But as you can see from the kind of fuzzy nature of the boundaries on this picture, there's a sizable error bar in this prediction. And this error essentially reflects the fact that we don't have a very good understanding of the nuclear force yet. So by making experimental investigations of nuclei, we hope to improve our theoretical descriptions and eventually come to a better understanding of the strong force. So a common misconception that one often encounters is that nuclei are spherical. In fact, the majority of nuclei prefer to take on non-spherical shapes. Like the Earth, some of them are compressed at the poles and are oblate shaped. Some of them prefer to look like rugby balls, what we call prolate deformation, and yet others prefer to be pear-shaped. And as you see in the upper right-hand corner of this slide, some nuclei even can take on several different shapes, just with a small difference in excitation. So by changing shape, the nucleus can lower its total energy and gain stability. And in the laboratory, we can excite the nucleus and get it to emit gamma rays. And by looking at observing this pattern of gamma rays, we can learn something about the atomic nucleus. And if I take this spectrum, which is measured in uvascular in the bottom left-hand corner, this kind of regular picket fence structure tells me immediately that this nucleus is prolate shaped, like a rugby ball. And a common theme in nuclear physics is to search for patterns which nature produces for us. Often we'll make a systematic study of a particular property and see how this varies over a sequence of nuclei. For example, we can keep the number of protons fixed and vary the number of neutrons to look at a sequence of isotopes. And very often when we plot properties in this way, we see discontinuities in what would otherwise be rather smooth behaviour. Nuclei with these particular numbers of protons and neutrons where we see the discontinuity have special properties. So we call these numbers magic numbers. And similar effects are seen in atomic physics, which is due to the effect of the electrons being in shells in the atom. The upper figure of this slide shows the first ionization potential, how it changes the function of element number. And this provides evidence for the shell structure in the atomic case. And the lower figure here shows how the neutron binding energy changes as a function of neutron number, highlighting the nuclear shell structure. And these discontinuities can then be related to the allowed energy levels which the nucleons can take. And this is shown in the figure here, where we see large gaps, 2, 8, 20, 28, 50, 82, and 126, which are these magic numbers. So it's found that these nuclei with magic numbers are more strongly bound than others. And simply put, this means they're more stable than other nuclei. They're harder to push into deformed or non-spherical shapes, and they're harder to excite. And the figures here show an example. So this is the energy of an excited state in a large range of nuclei. And the two large peaks and the ridges which you see in the upper left correspond to proton number 50 or neutron number 82 and also to neutron number 126. So these large peaks correspond to lead 208 and tin 132. So the heaviest nucleus that we know, which has a magic number for both protons and neutrons, is lead 208, with 82 protons and 126 neutrons. So not long after the development of the Shell model in 1949, predictions started to appear of where the next magic numbers would be beyond the ones which we currently know. And this led to this concept of the island of stability, which would be a region of nuclei which had extra stability, which are detached from those that we know. So they would have proton, the next magic proton number beyond 82, and the next magic neutron number beyond 126. So the nuclei in this region are known as superheavy elements. And still the exact location and size of this island is a topic of debate, especially in the theoretical community. And experimentally, there are two ways to try and approach the island. The first involves that we try and directly produce these nuclei, which have about 300 nucleons. And even in our best facilities, the difficulty of these experiments means that it's very difficult to produce more than a handful of events. And in terms of the absolute cross-section, we can say that the production is similar to that for some of the channels of the producing for Higgs boson. And a typical example here, or an extreme example, is that for element 113. So from 2004 to 2012, a group in Japan tried to produce element 113. And after 553 days of running, they managed to produce three atoms. Now, if we have such a small number of atoms, it's very difficult to say something about the nuclear properties. So in my own research, we use an alternative approach where we try to produce nuclei with a lower number of nucleons, around 250. And these can then be made a level of hundreds or thousands per week. And we can study them in more detail and learn more about the properties of the nuclei, which can in turn allow us to test our nuclear theories in a much better way. So in order to make these experiments successfully, a huge number of different components are needed. This starts with an ion source and an accelerator, which provides a beam of atoms which are used to bombard a target of another element and to induce a nuclear reaction. The radiation emitted from the nuclei is made with complex arrays of detectors, and then the signals from these detectors are processed electronically and the data collected and stored for analysis using specially developed software. So without going into detail, a successful experiment requires, amongst other things, a knowledge of plasma physics, accelerator physics, vacuum technology and engineering, radiation detection, materials physics, electronics, data acquisition, software development, programming, counting statistics, and finally nuclear theory. And then this is not to mention the fact that alongside this there must be considerable project management skills in dealing with these large international collaborations and these huge experiments. Now, innovations in many of these fields come from purely allowing scientists to answer a question in fundamental research that they're interested in. I've been lucky enough to have my research funded through the European Research Council, whose research criteria are solely based on the scientific goals. And very often, we're required to justify our research in terms of innovation or multidisciplinary aspects, which often forces those of us involved in fundamental research to somehow artificially add these aspects to our proposals. So I think it would be preferable if funding bodies could take a more long-term view and let the innovation come naturally. So of course, running such complicated experiments and equipment is not something that is done by one person alone. And in our department, we have this fantastic, hard-working team which runs about 15 experiments per year. And also here, I would like to especially mention Professors Rana Yulin and Matti Leino, who have mentored me and guided me through my whole career in neurovascular for the past 15 years or so. So to summarise, I would say the Accelerator Laboratory in the Department of Physics provides an excellent environment for research into nuclear and accelerator-based physics. It's an integral part of the department, which means there are fantastic opportunities for education of young students and to expose them to international research environments at a young age. And whilst the worldwide trend in nuclear physics is moving towards larger facilities, such as the facility for antiproton and ion research, FAIR in Darmstadt, I think the role of smaller laboratories will remain in the future a very important one, both in terms of education, training, development, but also as facilities in their own right. In experimental nuclear physics, we usually use a very broad range of techniques and approaches to provide the answers which we need. And often this can't be provided by a single facility. So quite often what happens is a laboratory will find a niche area in which it can specialise and provide a service to the wider community. And finding these niches and maintaining our current level of success is our challenge for the future.